Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. The change of seasons is pretty spectacular here in the Triad, with gorgeous fall colors and warm, fragrant springs. But the musical seasons are equally captivating, especially during the summer months. May is Magnolia Baroque Month in Winston-Salem. In June, it's Boone's turn with the Appalachian Summer Festival and Greensboro's Eastern Music Festival. And this week begins chamber music season in Winston with Carolina Summer Music Festival. Do you like to see excellent musicians perform live, unplugged, in an intimate setting where you can actually hear what they're playing without having to strain? Well, Carolina Summer delivers big time, and co-director Joe Mount is here to talk it up. Then we take our hats off for one of the Triad's most famous native sons. O. Henry turns 150, and Greensboro's O. Henry magazine is making it a birthday bash to remember. Editor and best-selling author Jim Dotson has a story or two to share with us. Plus, we get to spend some quality time with our good friend Peter Karoff at the keyboard. Today, he joins me live with Brahms and Brendel Recital Hall, next on Triad Arts Up Close. Have you ever been to a really great chamber music concert? You know, one where you get lots of goosebumps and you leave the performance wanting to talk about what you've just heard? Well, if you have, chances are you've been counting the days till Carolina Summer Music Festival 2012. World-class chamber musicians performing incredibly varied programs in unusual venues throughout Winston-Salem that might just surprise you. Carolina Summer Music Festival begins Friday, August 10th at 7:30 with an out-of-this-world brass ensemble performing live in Salem Square for free. This year, through August 25th, the mix of music and musicians is just as eclectic and exciting as ever. There will be a burnin' jazz band tribute to Hoagy Carmichael, an evening of cowboy songs, and a musical feast, literally, at Old Salem Visitor Center. Claude Debussy turns 150 at the Kuhn Studio Gallery, and this year at Cranky's Coffee downtown, Carolina Summer takes you from panpipes to Paquito. Carolina Summer Music Festival is directed by French hornist Joe Mount. Joe stopped by for a season preview.
The first concert we're going to present is a free concert featuring the music of the 26th Regiment, which was based at Old Salem. At the time, it was just called Salem. And this was the band that was attached to that regiment. It was made up of Moravian musicians. And before the war, they just gave concerts for the community, and they played for ceremonies and drill with the 26th Regiment. And along comes the Civil War, and next thing you know, this group of Moravian musicians are headed off to places like Gettysburg. And they're accompanying the regiment to the battlefield. They actually brought their part books back to Salem with them at the end of the war. They're the only surviving complete set of band books from one of the Confederate armies. And they're in the Moravian Music Foundation. And we have pulled together 9 brass players and 2 percussionists.
How about that?
And so the tunes we're going to play are pulled from their band books. Nola Knaus has edited them and transcribed them, you know, in modern notation. They're just a wonderful variety of sort of marches, gallops, popular songs. And it really is special. And considering that we're performing the music of this band in the venue, which is the square, the same venue that they would have been performing in the 1860s.
And recreating that great sound of the 26th Regiment in style with several of your colleagues in the Winston-Salem Symphony, Giannini Brass, and what a great sounding group. From marches to romanticism and an evening of romantics at Rinalda. What's on the program?
Well, this will be a nice variety of pieces performed by Jackie Carrasco, Glenn Siebert, the wonderful tenor, and Peter Karoff, amazing pianist. So you'll hear a big sonata by Brahms, a G major Brahms sonata, which has a very difficult violin part and a very difficult piano part as well. It's a huge piece.
But beautiful writing.
Yeah.
And Brahms is always the pianist's nightmare, but always the pianist's reward as well.
Of course, Peter Karoff, there's no rest for Peter. He plays all the time. So Peter will perform some of his solo repertoire of American composers like McDowell that he loves to play, and he's recorded. And then he will play some songs with Glenn Siebert as well, some American repertoire songs by Amy Beach and George Chadwick as well.
So that Romantics at Rinalda comes up on Sunday, August 12th at 3 o'clock at Rinalda House Museum of American Art. And that's followed on Wednesday, the 15th at 7:30 at a very different venue and quite a twist, from panpipes to Paquito, as in Paquito de Rivera.
Paquito de Rivera, the Cuban-born saxophonist and composer, and panpipes referring to the Andes. This is our kind of casual, fun, yet contemporary potpourri of pieces that are either written by Latin composers or descendants of composers of Latin descent, or pieces that evoke a certain feeling of either Argentina or the Andes or Cuba. That's the theme.
And Paquito de Rivera, also a great jazz clarinetist, and his contribution on this will be Preludio y Merengue for clarinet and string quartet, a great piece. And if you've never heard this music, it's somehow familiar and yet new and rhythmic, and well, let's just listen to some of it. Always gone for a variety of music and new chamber music experiences. I think this year really is the pinnacle. You've reached the zenith in terms of variety, and great variety. Alive and Kicking comes next.
As I was walking one morning for pleasure, I spied a cowpuncher riding along.
Cowboy Songs of America's Wild West, and that's that concert's coming up Saturday, August 18th at 11 o'clock at one of your all's stalwart supporters, the Old Salem Visitor Center, James A. Gray Jr. Auditorium.
This program was put together by Mary Siebert. She wears many hats in the community. She's one of the directors of the Arts-Based Elementary, and she's a wonderful classical singer. She sings opera and lieder, and she has sung Ravel songs with us in the past, but the unknown Mary Siebert, or the little-known Mary Siebert, is the cowboy song Mary Siebert. She grew up in the Wild West herself.
Montana,
and is a big advocate and has recorded many of these cowboy songs, which are actually authentic cowboy songs. They're not pop songs or 20th century commercial songs like Rawhide or something like that.
Early next morning we'll round up the doggies, slap on their brands, pop off their tails, round up the horses, load up the chuck wagons, and throw those fogies upon the trail. Whoopie tie, I oh, get along, little dogies. It's your misfortune back that I'm my own. Whoopie tie, I oh, get along, little dogies. For you know why Oban will be your new home.
Mary will have other musicians with her. Martha Bassett will be singing backup vocals. She has a banjo player, a fiddler, and a pianist as well.
Carolina Summer Music Festival co-artistic director and French hornist Joe Mount. Carolina Summer 2012 begins tonight at 7:30 in beautiful Salem Square with an all-star ensemble featuring the music of Salem's Confederate 26th Regimental Brass Band. Bring your lawn chair and enjoy 19th century music live right where it was first performed. This world-class chamber music festival runs through Saturday, August 25th, and you'll find the complete performance calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and coming up in the second half of the show, we'll get a live, free sample of Carolina Summers' Romantics at Rinalda concert. We'll join our good friend, pianist Peter Karoff, and my wife, violinist Jackie Carrasco, live in Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake campus. The violin sonata in G major by the great German composer Johannes Brahms is on the menu, and you've got a front row seat. But next up, it's time to get in touch with our literary roots, so to speak, with two triad legends in the world of the written word. Does the name William Sidney Porter ring a bell? No? Well, here's a clue. He was born in Greensboro on September 11th, 1862. Oh, and there's a new periodical in the triad that bears his name. It's called O. Henry Magazine. And on this, the 150th anniversary of O. Henry's birth, O. Henry Magazine turns exactly one. The Greensboro-based Arts and Culture Magazine has an outstanding stable of award-winning writers, and on its one-year anniversary, O. Henry wants to give back. So on Friday night, September 21st at 6:30, O. Henry Magazine is throwing a fundraising gala. Where else? The O. Henry Hotel in Greensboro, of course. Proceeds benefit the educational programs of the Greensboro Historical Museum, like local productions of O. Henry plays and the revival of the O. Henry Short Story Award. Decades ago, my guest today won that award. Since then, he's gone on to pen several best-selling books, and his work has appeared in more than 50 magazines and newspapers worldwide. He's founding editor of O. Henry Magazine, Jim Dodson. How's the book tour been?
The book tour is going great. It's been really fun. I've done about 50 golf clubs from Georgia to, I'm going to be doing them up to Maine to George Bush's club in the next few weeks, sort of, and that finishes it up by the end of the summer.
We're talking about your most recent book, American Triumvirate, and I understand it's doing incredibly well since the March publication?
It has done. I think one reason is that this is the 100th anniversary of Sneed, Hogan, and Nelson, their births, and all of whom had, by the way, have very deep roots here in the triad.
That's
they all
right.
won their tournaments here. Sam won Greensboro a record 8 times. Byron won here. Ben Hogan won at Greensboro. So they all loved it here. And it has done very well. And I've been very, very grateful for that. I mean, this is my 10th book. And I guess I've now entered the realm, that scary realm of being a kind of a golf historian curmudgeon. I grew up in Greensboro playing golf, obviously at Green Valley Golf Club, the old kind of semi-public club in Greensboro. And I wrote a book in 1997 called Final Rounds that's a was a huge bestseller, a total surprise to me, by the way. I thought if all my pink-eyed, lint-eared, redneck cousins in 3 or 4 counties around here bought a copy, it might sell 200 copies. That's if my mother bought 100 of them. In fact, it got on the bestseller list, and they sent me around the country for 25 talks and then 50 stops and got back to our house in Maine the night before a big snowstorm. And it's the night before Christmas Eve, and I'd promised to our little bookstore signing on the coast of where Bowdoin College is in Brunswick, Maine, if you know where that is, where L.L. Bean is. Anyway, long story short, my wife and kids had gone up to Grandma's house for the holiday, and I decided I'd do the signing, and I drove over in the start of the storm. And sure enough, just as I was getting out of my truck, the phone rang, and it was this nice woman said, "Mr. Dodson, this is Winnie Palmer. Arnold and I just wanted to let you know we've read Final Rounds, and we think it's the most beautiful book we've ever read." Now, it's a golf book, I guess, only tangentially. It's about when I took my dad when he was dying of cancer back to England and Scotland where he played during World War II, and all these things came out. And I said, "Well, wow, that's great." And she said, "Well, and moreover, I wanted to ask you to write Arnold Palmer's memoirs." So, wow, what a surprise, except that read the bubble over my head, I thought, I know exactly who this is. This is not Winnie Palmer. These are my buddies, and they're at Ham's and with their wives, and they've had a few pictures, and they want to really stick a needle in me because this book is on the bestseller list. So I said, "Well, Mrs. Palmer, thank you very much. I'm very grateful. The truth is the Nicholases are coming to Maine this weekend, and I'm picking them up in the airport in 10 minutes, in fact, and we're going to go to a party out on Small Point, and if it goes like it usually does, we're going to get pretty drunk, and Barbara and I are likely to make out like bandits. I'll have to call you back," and I hung up on her. I went in. I signed my 2 books. I went home in the blizzard. The little red light's blinking. Push the button. Hear the same lady laugh. She says, "Mr. Dodson, this really is Winnie Palmer." And she says, "Arnold thought that was the funniest thing he's ever heard. Would you call us back in the morning?" So I did, after I thanked God that the Palmers had a great sense of humor and kind of dream come true for a kid who grew up playing golf and sneaking on every course in the triad. He asked me to write his memoirs. I did it. We'd spent 3 years doing it. Days later, when he was diagnosed with cancer, he basically withdrew from the tour, and I got to spend 2 years living with him and writing, traveling with Arnold, and it was just joyful. We remain very close to this day. That led to the Hogan estate calling me, asking me to write the definitive Hogan biography. He's the most enigmatic, probably, athlete in American history. Mm. One survived a terrible crash. It was a cold, forbidding character who never explained himself because of his terrible childhood that I explore in the book. And that book won the International Book Award for the best sports book. I thought I might be finished with golf, and then I decided I'd move back to Southern Pines and Pioneers 5 years ago now for the U.S. Open and decided to stay. I wrote A Son of the Game, which is back coming back to my roots and bringing my own college boy son, who just graduated from Elon a month ago, back to North Carolina. So that's the sequence. And then now it's American Triumvirate.
You mentioned that award, an international mm-hmm. sports mm-hmm. award, and then the here more locally, mm-hmm. Order of the Longleaf Pine Award.
Well, that one made me cry. That was only about 2 months ago.
Tell me what the response was, and what were you thinking when you got that? And does that put more responsibility on you as a writer
moving forward? I was always very surprised, actually, when I would win an award, because I don't take anything for granted. And when you come from humble farming people of the triad like I do, you know, my dad was a very hardworking guy and a self-educated man and went to 1 year college in Carolina, and I did feel that responsibility. So in any case, I've been very lucky to win some wonderful awards. And so when Final Rounds came out, Sam Snead called me. He was a colorful, controversial character. And he asked me, he said, Jim, and Sam called me. I said, and he's in Final Rounds just briefly as a cameo. And he says, I decided I'm about ready to write my autobiography, and I want you to do it. I know you just did Arnold's. And I said, well, Sam, that's great. He's the winningest player in golf history. And long story short, I said, well, but Sam, the problem is that you've written your autobiography twice already. And he goes, I know. Damn, I ain't done living yet. He was wonderful. I turned him down because I just accepted the chance to do Hogan's biography. That's his leading rival. So wouldn't you know, not one night in 1999, the Palmer book had just been out a year. I came down to take my mother to dinner at Lucky 32 in Greensboro for her birthday. When January night, walk in, who do I see in the booth but Sam Snead and three women? And he waves us over, and he says, you know, about ready to get started on that book of ours. And my mother blurts out, well, Sam, you know, it's interesting. Jim's going down to see Ben. He's going to do Ben Hogan's book next. And to his credit, he didn't get crazy, but he kind of gave me that long catfish stare of his and said, well, you're going down to Texas and talk to those people, and when you want to know what the hell really happened, you come see me up in Hot Springs. And, David, here's the neat part about this. I knew Byron Nelson, too, and the three of them were born 100 years ago in 1912. When Bobby Jones left golf in 1930, they were 17 years old, essentially, and they were unknown poor farm boys. Bobby Jones was a country club kid who grew up with money and affluence and access and went to Harvard and was a real scion. And Walter Hagen and Gene Saracen, the other two stars of the 1920s, were colorful pros who made a pile of money but only rarely played. And when Jones left in 30, the crash had occurred and golf basically died. So I wanted to tell the story of these three remarkable guys, all born the same year, two of whom came out of the same caddy yard in Fort Worth, and one who came from the backwoods of Virginia, the poorest county in Virginia, who rose to worldwide fame and stardom. Three couldn't have been more different in personality. Not only saved golf, in many ways, other sports as well in the 1930s because they became these marquee names, but they really did establish the modern PGA Tour in the world of golf that Arnold Palmer inherited and took to new heights.
You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with best-selling author and O. Henry Magazine editor Jim Dodson. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about his new book, American Triumvirate, how Ben Hogan, Sam Snead, and Byron Nelson created the modern age of golf. And then it's on to Jim's other passion, O. Henry Magazine. He and his staff are celebrating their one-year anniversary by expanding the magazine's offerings. And on this, the 150th anniversary of O. Henry's birth, they're also spreading the word of O. Henry's greatness next, when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I've been talking with award-winning author and O. Henry Magazine editor Jim Dodson. Jim's new book, American Triumvirate, How Ben Hogan, Sam Snead, and Byron Nelson Created the Modern Age of Golf, was released by Knopf Press in March, and it's already in its third printing. Next, we'll talk a little more about his book, and then it's all O. Henry all the time.
Golf was a real rough and tumble game, professional golf, and that's really all there was. The amateurs played at, you know, tournaments and stuff like the U.S. Amateur, but the sport of golf as a profession was basically a kind of a vagabond's game in the 1930s. These tournaments were strung from sort of Southern California after Christmas all the way to the Carolinas here in the spring. And club pros released from their jobs till summer would go out and play in these tournaments. And two or three places was really – you had to end up to make any money. Half of these tournaments basically went out of business in the 1930s. There was no – you know, it was not the tour you see today by any stretch. And so these guys were hustlers. A lot of them were, as I say, club pros sharing expenses. A lot of them were con men rolling from town to town. It was a rough and tumble, a vagabond's life. And as I say, it really – by the time Sam Snead hitched a ride out there with a guy named Johnny Bulla from Burlington in 1937 to try his luck, he had about $50 on him, and he had several – I think he had 12 clubs instead of the 14 in his bag, and he won. And he was this colorful, funny, shy, good-looking farm boy who suddenly in Oakland where he won – the second week of the season was very was instantaneous copy because he was like Goober Pyle. He came out with these kind of goofy farm boy gee whiz things. He was scared of the photographers, and he actually fled. But he also had the most beautiful golf swing anybody had ever seen. Long before there was Tiger Woods, there was Sam Snead, who was so athletic. He was a four-star athlete growing up in the mountains in Virginia, and he got offers of scholarships to Virginia and Virginia Polytech, as they called it in those days. When he won five times in 1937, suddenly golf had its biggest star since Bobby Jones had left the game, and the game had pretty much collapsed. That same spring, Byron Nelson, who was a sweet, sunny, cheerful farm boy from Waxahachie, Texas, who was very Christian because he'd survived typhoid fever at age 10 and given his life to Christ, he won his first Masters, and he became a favorite of Bobby Jones and Cliff Roberts. And then 3 years later, Ben Hogan broke through and won at Pinehurst. And here's just one little thing. They were passing the hat at Augusta when Byron won in 1937. If you can imagine, if you see the Augusta on TV, they were passing the hat to keep that place open.
Wow.
Byron wins, and suddenly everybody wants to come and see what's going on there. And between 1937, when Byron won that first Masters, and 1953, when Ben pretty much left the game, retired, and leaving only Sam Snead. One of the three of those guys was first, second, or third in the tournament about 65% of the times. They won 198 tournaments, 21 major championships, and set about 17 different scoring records. And it's a period of dominance that's unequaled in any sport. Again, as I say, the three couldn't have been more colorful and different. And each of them had their partisans. And one of the things I do talk about early in the book is how in the world of golf – across its 400-year-old history, whenever there have been two or three or ideally four players who were dominant, the game has prospered. And here's a little factoid that's pretty interesting. Between 1960, when Arnold won his second major championship, he won his second Masters that year, and then he won the U.S. Open later that summer, and 1996, when Nick Faldo won his last, that's just a 36-year period, roughly a human generation, the game of golf grew about eightfold in America in terms of participation. 24 million people took up the game. Tiger Woods entered golf that same summer, was paid $80 million before he ever hit a ball in competition, a place nobody had ever been. Corporate America jumped into golf, just ramped up the game. Prices went sky high. Everybody was creating golf products. It was a mania. But in that time, from then to now, with one guy claiming all the attention, all the airtime, Tiger Mania, more people have quit playing golf than taken it up. It's the first time in about 50 years. So it's an interesting phenomenon. And I contend, and I sketch this out in the book, it's because rivalries and competition is great for anything. And when you have three colorful characters like Sam Snead, who played the game until he was in his 80s, as smooth as a Spanish diplomat at one minute and bawdy as an L.A. comic the next, Ben Hogan, quiet, inscrutable. His father shot himself in front of him when he was 9 years old. He was thrust into this life of Dickensian poverty, grew up to be this cold, implacable scoring machine nobody understood, never would talk, became an iconic figure after he survived this horrible crash and came back to win four major championships. And then you have Byron Nelson, who not only innovated the modern golf swing with steel shafts, but went on to become a great commentator on TV and created a golf tournament, gave his name to the Byron Nelson Classic in Dallas that has raised more than $250 million for children's charities and became the model for giving in tournament charities on the PGA Tour. So these really were the godfathers and the grandfathers and the founders of the modern PGA Tour, and that's the story I tell.
Jim, I understand you're branching off into the world of film now as well.
Well, I did write a screenplay, The Final Round, that may someday turn into a film. It's been altered three times, but really fun. I mean, literally this morning I finished sending off the script for a documentary on the Golf Channel that's going to air on around the book, American Triumvirate, that airs on the, I believe it's the Monday night. It's the 13th of August, which is Ben Hogan's 100th birthday. And it's airing that night, I think it's at 7 o'clock, on the book and these three remarkable guys. So that's kind of a treat. I just did discover, it's probably a little bit like working, maybe you're the same in the radio world. If you're a writer, you like to write. And then they say, just cut that by two-thirds, and it works. So it's been excruciating working this script, but I was working with a fabulous producer who's done all the stuff for Augusta for CBS for years, so it's been really a treat.
Well, and congratulations.
Thank
on
you.
Sylvester Stallone, Robert Duvall, and De Niro. I mean, just an unbelievable
They're all lining up. They're all lining up. They all went in. But we got to see their golf swings first.
William S. Porter.
Yeah.
1862 to 1910. Who was this guy? Why should we care about him 100 years on? 150 years later.
Yeah. Well, this is the 150th anniversary of his birth, and he had an interesting, and from a writer's perspective, a checkered past that made him such an interesting character. He grew up essentially raised by an uncle in Greensboro and grew up on Polecat Creek, which is sort of south of Greensboro. He worked in his uncle's drugstore, dreaming of fame in somehow far-off places. He was a reader, a voracious reader. At 19, he struck off for Texas to sort of make his fortune. Went to Austin, Texas, and he courted a local banker's daughter and married her, and they had children, and he started a magazine called Rolling Stone. He fancied himself, he was very much a dandy. If you look in the new issue of O'Henry, you'll see we have a gala on the 21st. It's a fundraiser for the Greensboro Historical Museum and the O'Henry Plays, which are the longest running in America, that happen every year. And there's a fabulous picture of him holding a kind of a Japanese umbrella. He was an absolute dandy. He worked for a bank. He went to work for a bank and to sort of enhance his income. And his wife gave birth to a daughter, fell ill with, like, I think it was typhoid fever, and died. And he, shortly thereafter, was accused of embezzling from the bank, and he fled for Panama. And he lived there for a year or two. And during that time, he taught himself basically to write or refined his writing technique. He came back to see his daughter. He was arrested, tried, probably on trumped-up charges, sent to jail for embezzlement, sent to a modest security prison in Ohio where he kind of ran the laundry for 2 years. And during that time, he was thinking how he could rehabilitate himself. And he changed his name to O'Henry, started submitting short stories to people like the Atlantic Monthly and other periodicals, and they took him. And in 1905, 1907, 1910, he'd moved to New York. He was the best-paid writer in the world. He was even more famous than Mark Twain. His stories were so beloved. Of course, the ones that everybody knows are The Ransom of Red Chief and Gift to the Magi, second most popular story in the world after Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol. And he's a very approachable storyteller. He always has rogues and characters and funny people, and it's always kind of gentle love stories that go awry. And look at The Gift to the Magi. The wife wants to buy her young newlywed husband a gold chain for the watch his father gave him, and he does buy her, in fact, a beautiful combs for her hair. She cuts off her hair and sells it to buy the watch chain. He sells the watch to buy the combs. So, you know, and at the end of the day, love is all that matters. Well, when we decided to start creating this magazine, the first name and the only name I could think of to call this magazine, as we said a year ago on your show, was O'Henry.
We have 1 year anniversary for O'Henry.
It is. We're a storyteller's magazine. And so we write about food, culture, sports. We have great columnists. And the headline for us is that we're going monthly. We have been bi-monthly and double arts page with the occasional piece from Winston. An expansion of High Points Arts as well. So little by little, we're moving this way. Part of my mission is to create a platform for young writers to give them an opportunity to break in, and poets. And part of our celebration of O'Henry's 150th and going monthly next month will be we've revived the O'Henry Short Story Award that I won, whatever it was, 30 or 40 years ago. And we've had over 75 or 80 entries from kids and people, and it's going to be really fun.
Tell me a little bit more about this fundraising gala plan to raise money for O. Henry Plays and the revival of the short story award that you just referenced.
Well, here. Dennis Quaintance, who's just
owner of the Lucky 32 restaurant, among others.
And the new O. Henry Hotel, which is spectacular.
Beautiful hotel.
We got this idea. We work closely with the Historical Museum, and we had wanted to do something to sort of enhance the public love of O. Henry and opportunities for people to know about him. They have run every year, generally during 17 days, but going back 25 years, a thing called the 5 by O. Henry Plays. And they're very short vignettes. They're really funny, great music and costume, and they're adaptations from some of his better-known stories. And it's been a big success, but it never had an underwriter. And I said, well, what if we created a great dinner, a kind of a dinner from 100 years ago when O. Henry was at his peak, and we showcased the plays, and we really create a menu from 100 years ago. Dennis and his fabulous staff at the O. Henry's taken off, and so it's going to be $150 and 150 people on the 150th birthday of O. Henry on the 21st of September. It's going to be a wonderful, fun night to raise money to sort of underwrite those plays permanently.
My thanks to best-selling author, recent recipient of the Order of the Longleaf Pine, and founding editor of O. Henry Magazine, Jim Dodson. Jim's new book, American Triumvirate, How Ben Hogan, Sam Snead, and Byron Nelson Created the Modern Age of Golf, was released in March of 2012 on Knopf, and it's already in its third printing. On Friday night, September 21st at 6:30, O. Henry Magazine is throwing a fundraising gala at the O. Henry Hotel in Greensboro, of course, with a five-course gourmet meal, live music, visits from O. Henry play characters, and more. Proceeds benefit the educational programs of the Greensboro Historical Museum, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short intermission, get set for a little chamber music. First, it's Understanding Franz Schubert with Karoff at the keyboard, and then Peter will be joined by violinist Jackie Carrasco live in Brendel Recital Hall with some truly beautiful music by Johannes Brahms, his violin sonata in G major. It's coming up next when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. And now it's time for my favorite part of the show, Understanding Classical Music, with Karoff at the keyboard.
You know, Franz Schubert wrote a tremendous amount of music in his very brief life. He was only 31 years old when he died, and yet he wrote symphonies and chamber music and operas, piano pieces, and most of all, he wrote songs. Lots and lots and lots of songs, over 600 songs of a particular type that we call Lieder, L-I-E-D-E-R, Lieder. A lead, or multiple Lieder, works like this. You get a poem that you think would make a nice song. You give a melody to the poem so that a singer can sing the words of the poem, and you write a little piano accompaniment to back up the singer, and there's your Lieder. Well, Schubert was a master at writing songs that added something to the poem, so it wasn't just simply a pretty melody, but it gave sort of an added insight into the meaning of the poem and created something that was greater than the sum of its parts. In particular, the piano accompaniments are very colorful. For example, if in a poem a young girl is sitting at the spinning wheel and she's talking about her agitation at her first kiss and wonders what's coming, and the piano part isn't simply harmonies behind the singer, but we can hear the spinning wheel spinning. Another song is talking about a young man looking at a fisherman catching a trout. And you, in the piano part, you can practically see the little fish darting here and there in the water. A young man might be saying to a brook, "Oh, bring my message of love to my beloved." And sure enough, in the piano part, you can hear the little brooklet babbling away. Well, once you've heard a few of these Lieder, and then you go back and you hear the music that doesn't have words, you can't help but hear those same kinds of melodies and those same kinds of accompaniments. Schubert's music is infused with song, even when it's not being sung. Here, listen to this piece for piano. It doesn't have a singer, And nevertheless, when I hear it, I can't help but imagine a singer singing. And when I imagine that singer singing, therefore I imagine an imaginary poem being sung as well. Music that sounds for all the world like a song, like one of his hundreds and hundreds of lieder, and nevertheless just written for the piano. As we imagine what is being sung, each of the harmonies then take on new meaning. We have our basic harmony here, and he adds this little note down below. When it repeats, the second time it's a little note of regret, perhaps. You see what I mean, that the music of Schubert, even when there's no poetry, even when there's no singer, is like a song. More than 600 lieder, 9 symphonies, string quartets, piano pieces, trios, on and on and on. I don't know how he had time to do it in his brief time on earth, 31 years. Franz Schubert.
Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the Keyboard. And my thanks once again to the pianist and Wake Forest University Professor of Music, Mr. Peter Karoff. And now joining Peter here in Brendel Recital Hall on the campus of Wake Forest University is violinist Jackie Carrasco. In full disclosure, Jackie is my lovely wife, a professor of music at Wake Forest University, and the co-director, along with French hornist Joe Mount, of the Carolina Summer Music Festival. The festival kicks off tonight at 7:30 in Salem Square. It'll be a free outdoor concert for brass ensemble featuring the music of Salem's Confederate 26th Regimental Brass Band and readings from the letters of Carrie Fries, a young woman from Salem, and her fiancé, J. Frank Schaffner, a surgeon with the 26th Regiment. On Sunday, August 12th at 3 o'clock, Carolina Summer presents Romantics at Rinalda, featuring songs and piano miniatures by celebrated American composers Amy Beach, George Chadwick, and Edward McDowell, with pianist Peter Karoff and tenor Glenn Siebert. Peter will also be joined by violinist Jackie Carrasco to perform Music by Brahms, his violin sonata in G major. If you've never heard the Brahms violin sonata in G major, you owe it to yourself to either purchase it or come out and hear it live, even better, with the Carolina Summer Music Festival performance. And here, live, not in Studio A today, but live on the beautiful Brendel Hall stage at Wake Forest University with violinist Jacqueline Carrasco and our good friend Peter Karoff, or Karoff at the Keyboard. And, hey, you know, listening to you all run through this in rehearsal, it just reminded me of the really neat rhythmic things that Brahms turns to so often. In this case, the whole concept of hemiola. I wonder if you could give us an example of that. And it sounds like a blood product, but it's really... Uh-huh. Peter, what is a hemiola? And then how about an early on example of this rhythmic device that Brahms uses?
Yeah, hemiola is a funny word, sometimes pronounced hemiola, but anyhow, it's basically a rhythmical game that composers use, and Brahms loved to play this game more often than most composers. Basically, you set up a rhythmical pattern or a metrical pattern. So let's say you're going in the music 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and then in a moment of hemiola, the meter seems to shift within it. So you're going 1-2-3-4-5-6. A famous example might be in Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, where it's going, "I want to be in America." Well, that's a perfect example of a hemiola, where it's going 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-1-2, 1-2, da 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 da. And Brahms loves to play this game where you're sort of in 3, you're sort of in two, and lots of times you're in both at once. For example, in this sonata, the meter is in multiples of three, so you have 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Then later the violin goes 1, 2, 3. You're not sure what meter you're in, da, 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 or is it da, da, da? Compounding that, it's almost like a hemiola within hemiola. The piano does this. He extends that out over 6, 7 measures, and finally you find the downbeat. It's really a fun and kind of playful and at the same time extremely expressive way to treat rhythm.
Hey, could we hear that section with you and Jackie playing? This is just right around bar 10 where that begins.
Yeah, so the spot we're going to play, the violin comes in 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and then shifts over to 1 and 2 and 1 and 2, and underneath it, the piano's going 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So you've got layers upon layers of rhythmical shifting going on.
Oh, I just love that. He really creates like a dreamscape with that sort of a rhythmical thing going on, like this cloud of sound. It's beautiful.
I feel like when the meter shifts out from under you, it's almost like the rolling deck of a ship. You think you're standing in a triple meter, and suddenly it starts shifting into a duple meter. And so these expressive harmonies shifted metrically. The rhythm shifted in such a really playful way, I think.
One place where it's just rock solid is just, even at the very beginning, this theme, it just grounds you immediately. And I don't know, as so many things with Brahms, it sounds perfectly appropriate in his time, but it sounds so kind of modern at the same time. But talk about some of the theme, the thematic material he uses and where he gets his stuff, because I understand this theme actually emanated from song.
You know, Brahms likes to play with something called motives, just short little fragments of two or three notes, but this piece is filled with melody upon melody upon melody. We always use the word lyrical to describe it, and lyrical meaning singable. You know, it's like it would fit the human voice. So he's treating the violin almost like a singer. The melody that you hear in the violin at the beginning, that motive is taken actually from a song that Brahms wrote a few years earlier. It was a favorite of Clara Schumann's. And in a way, this sonata is almost a kind of a present or a gift to his friend Clara Schumann, and also to his friend, the violinist, Josef Joachim.
So, as so often happens with Brahms, it's not even just one beautiful theme going on, but multiple themes, or in this case, two biggies.
I got to say, you know, Brahms is one of my favorite composers, but this moment is one of my favorite moments in all of Brahms. It's a beautiful and expressive melody you hear on top. Great tune, very memorable, very singable, very lyrical. But what's going on underneath it is also beautiful and adds to the poignancy of it. You have a counter melody going down the scale. So together, those two go. Very simple counter melody going down the major scale. Underneath those things, you have what's called a pedal point, a bass note that doesn't change. Well, what happens when a bass note doesn't change is, first of all, it gives it a kind of a rootedness, a groundedness, and it gives it a kind of almost pastoral feeling. It kind of evokes the world of bagpipes, and that's an old traditional technique that composers like to use. So you've got these beautiful shifting harmonies on top of this static bass. And oh yeah, the world's most beautiful melody on top. Let's try it. gets me every time.
Me too. Well, listen, and nobody does reflection like Brahms. I'd love to give listeners a taste of just how he comes back to a theme after you've already heard it laid out in so many different beautiful ways. And this, I think on page 11 it starts, this moment of reflection that I've come to love about Brahms, and I'd love to share that with listeners before we play this whole movement.
Yeah, here Brahms takes our opening melody, our opening idea, da, 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 and just kind of reflects upon it, and it's like holding a crystal up to the light and turning it various ways, and he's moving slowly toward the chord that we're seeking, but when we finally find it, he kind of subverts it and adds to that poignancy of the moment of arrival.
If it gets any more beautiful than that, I don't want to have anything to do with it. That's just gorgeous.
You know, that's a great example of why I think Brahms is not only one of my favorite composers, but really one of the greatest composers out there. It's because what he's doing, you can talk about intellectually, you can look at the rhythms and the motives and the form and all of those technical things, but finally, when you hear the thing, you just go, wow, that's so beautiful. So it gets you in the heart and in the head at the same time and in equal measure. That's why I think he's just so great.
All right. Well, thanks, Peter, and thanks, Jackie. Let's hear this now. This is the first movement from the Violin Sonata in G Major by Johannes Brahms. Violinist Jackie Carrasco and pianist Peter Karoff. Thank you.
We heard from pianist Peter Kiroff and violinist Jackie Carrasco. Together, they'll perform the Brahms Violin Sonata in G Major in its entirety on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Also on that program, songs and piano miniatures by celebrated American composers Amy Beach, George Chadwick, and Edward McDowell. Tenor Glenn Siebert will join them in song. On Sunday, it'll be day two of the Carolina Summer Music Festival, which begins tonight at 7:30 in Salem Square with a free concert of music for brass ensemble that you won't want to miss. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. That's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.